So some thoughts about post-corona from Parshas Maaseh, and in particular from the Rashi that appears right in the beginning of Parshas Maaseh. Now, I hope and I daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we all hope and daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that at least for most people, or many people listening to this year, I imagine in the Jewish English-speaking world, corona is slowly starting to ebb. Should be noted that there may be people listening to this in South Africa, and our tefillos go out because that community is still being hit very, very hard. And then also, obviously, even in Eretz Yisrael, we're finding there may be a rebound. So we hope that this is a post-corona moment that's reflected in Parshas Maaseh, which is a post-40-year moment, 40 years of darkness, 40 years of wandering, 40 years of helplessness. And the Torah is about to pick up the drama again of entering Eretz Yisrael, Parshas Matos. It's in the air. B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven approach Moshe, B'nai Tzalafchad, Parshas Pinchas, and then, of course, the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, the very famous Pasuk that, at least according to the Ramban, commands us to live in Eretz Yisrael. But even if it's not a commandment, it's certainly an instruction. In any event, so the beginning of Parshas Maaseh has this long list of nondescript locations, places we don't know where they are. Do they exist? Of course they exist, but their names have long since faded. Windswept dunes, possibly oases in the desert, endless, endless desert terrain. Why does the Torah, which normally economizes on its words, why does it spend so much time not just listing these places, but the departure and the arrival? I don't have the pasuk in front of me, but there's so many sukkim wasted on locations that we don't know about, we didn't read about, nor can we discover archaeologically, nor, quite frankly, are we interested in discovering them archaeologically. So the famous Rambam and others, I spoke about the Sfas Emes earlier this week. But Rashi provides two different approaches, and each of them, I think, helps us look back at difficult moments and think about faith. I think that anyone who undergoes a difficult experience, whether it's personally or collectively, Gemara says in Brachos, Yimashmesh b'maisav, Yifashmesh b'maisav. So part of it is a call for tshuva, introspection, change, and refurbishing your own world of Avodas Hashem. But part of it is, especially when it's not just a temporary passing crisis, but it's a tragedy or a trauma which you're trying to wrestle with, these two truths. There's one truth that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Kel Mali Rachamim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Ava Rachamim, Mechal Kol Chayim Bechased. Then this other truth that people suffer, and whether it's individual suffering or whole-scale suffering. So we've just undergone an experience. Some of us are still in the throes of it. But how do we think about Emunah? How do we think about our faith in the wake of 38 years of wandering and 38 years of death? In the wake of a year and a half of not wandering, but quarantine and stationary and breaking our schedules and losing so much of our routine and our dreams and our lives, and for many people, their actual lives. So the first approach in Rashi, very interesting one, does some math, some calculation. If you look at the number of trips, there are 42 trips or 42 encampments. However, there are 14 the first year and a half before the decree is handed down, around Tisha B'Av time of the second year after they left Mitzrayim, about a year and a half after the Exodus, after the departure. And there are about 8 in the final year. A lot of travel from and a lot of travel to in the last year, accelerating their way to Eretz Yisrael, of course, fleeing Egypt and departing as quickly as they could. So 42, a little tired this morning, but 42 minus 22, if I'm not mistaken, is about 20. And that leaves 20 different trips during 38 years. That's on average a trip every 2 years. So our image of the wandering people wandering through the desert, having no place, no location, no stability, nothing permanent in their lives, it's a myth. Now, it could be there were certain trips clustered in a particular year, but that just relieved the stress of journey from other years. So on average, once every 2 years. We don't know the timelines, but it's on average once every 2 years. I think it's the Or Zeruah River. You can see what I always quote in Or Zeruah, that claims that a certain type of a knot, I don't quote this as halach lemaisa, I don't know the exact terminology, but there's a big discussion what types of knots, K-N-O-T's, types of knots are usher on Shabbos, what types of knots are mutter on Shabbos, and one of the criteria, one of the parameters are Kesher Kavua, Kesher She'ena Kavua, Kesher Kayama, Kesher She'ena Shal Kayama. Is it a knot that has lasting durability, or it's one that's just very, very quick? You're tying it, you're going to untie it. And part of it is not just the quality of the knot, how strong the ropes are, but part of it is the intention of the human being, what the plans are. Anyway, at some point, some of the Rishonim, I believe it's the Or Zeror ben Yitzchak of Vienna, claim that since the entire halacha, the entire iser of making knots, is derived from the knots which were tied in the Beis HaMikdash to fasten down some of the curtains so they wouldn't flap in the wind, and in the Mishkan, they were made with a sense of permanence, so only permanent style knots, or only certain types of permanent style knots are usher. And that's fascinating. It was fascinating to the Luchnesin that the paradigm of permanence is our life in the desert. And if they were traveling, every other week, you would not view those knots as permanent. You would certainly not employ those Mishkan knots as a paradigm for permanent knots, which would be prohibited on Shabbos. So, and in fact, ironically, it would be more a bigger chumrah, because you'd say any knot is aser, because if the knots of the Mishkan were not permanent, and that's the paradigm for the malachos, then anything would be aser. But the halacha is only certain types of permanent knots, because the Mishkan were permanent knots, and our baseline or our template for malach on Shabbos is the Mishkan. Anyway, so they had respite. They had permanence. And Rashi sees this as a general gloss, that even when human beings suffer, and they suffered in the Midbar, this was a generation that died, this was a generation that felt cursed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Literally, there's a curse in Parsha Shlach. It's not as devastating and as nightmarish as it could be, as maybe it even should be. And in a very literal sense, first of all, it's a gloss or foreshadowing of Galus, that even though the Jewish people would spend 2,000 years relieving the curse of Churban Beis HaMikdash, relieving the curse of leaving Yerushalayim, and part of that Galus was not just to exit Yerushalayim, but to wander through history. In most instances, the wandering wasn't constant. In most instances, there were some moments of sporadic, constant movement. I think you could claim that the first part of the last century was such an example, where because, not particularly or exclusively, in the beginning of the century, because of events that were directed at the Jewish people, this is World War I and the commotion surrounding World War I, but if you start calculating from, let's say, 1880 through 1948, or if you stretch it a little to include the Aliyah from Arabic lands in the early 50s, you're looking at about 80 years, 70 years of tremendous tumult in the Jewish world, a lot of movement and re-movement, being that I'm an Ashkenazi, I'm more attuned to the Ashkenazic movement, which, at least in the World War I era, stretching through World War II, tend to be almost constant, where they were fleeing east during World War I, and they moved back west, and then a couple of 20 years later, World War II, and they fleed east again, and they were caught, and then people moved to DP camps, and it's almost as if they didn't have any permanent home. But that's not typical. It's not characteristic of our Gullus. What's more typical of our Gullus is we have a few hundred years in a particular location, and we establish ourselves, we establish our communities, and then we move on. Hopefully we move on voluntarily and in a position of strength, and we are able to migrate along with our wealth and our community and our lives. And sadly enough, sometimes we aren't. In Spain, we weren't able to move quietly and calmly. In Poland and Central Eastern Europe, we weren't able to move quietly and calmly. And only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows how the future unfolds and what American communities or what worldwide communities that have been built and established, seemingly built to last, seemingly established with strong foundations, where they're headed, and whether they'll move at the right time or when it's something which is compelled and coerced. But either way, Revach Tassimu ben Eder Leeder, when Yaakov instructs his associates in Parshas Vayishlach to put space between the camps, and of course in Yaakov's mind, it's to create escape possibilities for different parts of the camp, possibly to impress Esav that the camp is larger than it looks. But Chazal see this as, again, everything Yaakov does is a vision and foreshadowing of the future. Yaakov says there will be menucha, there will be revach, there will be space and air and breathing room between Eder and Eder, between the different encampments throughout history. But that's something which is latent in this first Rashi. Now, Rashi speaks about wandering, and therefore it's such a direct foreshadowing of our historical wandering. And anyone who reads Maaseh with a titch of historical sensitivity, of Jewish historical consciousness, can't help but associate the wandering in the desert with the wandering of the Jewish people throughout history. But there's a larger message in Rashi, and that larger message is that sometimes we suffer, and sometimes we suffer individually, sometimes we suffer collectively. But it doesn't mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't there, and it doesn't mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't showing us His mercy, and it doesn't mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't creating conditions to, if not alleviate the suffering, at least soften it and to round it out and to provide sustainability. Similar Rashi in Parshas Vayeshev, when Yosef is kidnapped and sold into slavery, and the Torah goes out of its way, wastes, quote-unquote, some words describing the sweet-smelling aromas and the sweet-smelling nuts and spices that his captives, his captors, his kidnappers were carrying in those caravans down to Egypt. And Yosef was such a tzaddik that Hashem rewarded him and cared for him, because typically those peddlers and those merchants would carry tanning agents and foul-smelling chemicals. And this is such a seemingly absurd medrash that Rashi quotes, because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares for Yosef, why is he being sold? Why is he being kidnapped? And it's a similar structure, that there's a larger calculus, and there's a larger calculus that sometimes allows or demands suffering. Then there's a micro calculus that even within suffering, it's not all or nothing. I think when we punish and when we treat people in a manner of justice, our tendency sometimes tends to be, these are criminals, these are hardened criminals, as we would say, let's throw the book at them and let's give them the maximal penalty. Now, in the modern world, we've been able to try to civilize a little bit our punishments, and we throw the book at someone. That doesn't mean we're throwing him in a dungeon and hanging him by his toenails, but he deserves, as every human being deserves, civil treatment and to have his rights protected and to live a life of food, shelter, warmth, care, medical care. But sometimes, at least emotionally, we tend to, people that we see in a way that deserve punishment, or people that we want to deny, we're very radical. We deny everything. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is much more metered. And certainly when he deals with the people that he loves, his children, and certainly when he deals with the Yosef and Tzaddik. So even though there may be conditions that are mandated, either out of punishment for Am Yisrael or historical exigency for Yosef, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still creating conditions and padding it and sustaining us. And if you just look between the cracks, we're able to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you talked to a lot of Holocaust survivors, and yesterday was Rav Amital's yard site, and Rav Amital was once asked in a famous interview on the Israeli radio or something, it's about 40 years ago, 50 years ago, where was Hashem during the Holocaust? And this was a question posed to him by a panelist, a secular panelist, who wasn't mocking him, but it was in disbelief that religion could be sustained after the Holocaust. And Rav Amital said, he was with me in Auschwitz. Now, I never followed up with Rav Amital and asked him, what did you mean? But to me, part of what that meant, and it resonates with what I heard from other people, what I read about, is that even though the nightmare that engulfed them was inexplicable, and where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why did he allow that nightmare? But if you looked in the day-to-day and minor miracles, minor arrangements that allowed people to survive, to find their families, I don't want to simplify the Holocaust. I think it's terrible when people simplify it and shrink it to, well, it's just a bunch of miracles that Hashem performed for Tzaddikim, were able to light Hanukkah Neris and say Avdallah because they found the proper material. This was a mind-bending tragedy. This was a history-altering apocalypse, and you can't just shrink it into miracles and Tzaddikim. But I think that a lot of the testimonies I've heard are reflective of this Rashi, and I certainly know that at least my own experience over the past year was reflective, where as everyone else, I was shaking my head in disbelief. As everyone else, I was suffering this terrible, terrible affliction, whether personal loss or just suffering along with humanity. But I was able to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's care, and the fact that it could have been worse, and just even something as simple as the timing. In the sweep of history, 20 years is a hiccup. 20 years is nothing. It doesn't make a difference whether it occurs in 2000 or 2020. But in the arc of human technology and human communication, the year 2000 would have been a lot more devastating than the year 220. We didn't yet have a fully operational internet. We certainly didn't have video conferencing, laptops, cell phones weren't as preponderant. So if you can just imagine the corona epidemic exploding in 2000 or 1990, we would have been locked up in our homes and very little communication. We would have been conducting sharing on phone lines, not even cell phones, but phone lines, one phone in the house, or a very, very different feel. Thank God, Baruch Hashem, it hit at least humanity, where much of the advanced world was in a relatively stable financial situation. Again, it's hard to speak in a way that doesn't sound gloating or triumphalist, because there are so many people, and so much about the epidemic is creating divisions between the first world and the second and third worlds, and we're starting to see as the first world is climbing out of the epidemic because of rapid vaccination. It's so sad to see these divisions creating countries of life and countries of death. Baruch Hashem, I live in a country of life, but it's hard to see, and I don't think it's anyone's fault. There's nothing diabolical. It's just the flow of human resources and currency and economic power. But much of the first world, so if you can imagine turning the clock back 12 years after the financial crisis of 2008, and if the epidemic follows on the heels of that financial crisis, one of my great worries at the start of the epidemic is how this would affect the financial stability of the world, and we're still in a very rocky and delicate, I'm not a financial analyst, but it should be obvious that we're still navigating our way, and we hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will allow humanity to continue to generate the resources and the wealth to support itself and to create stable and firm societies. So I think that first part of Rashi, that first Rashi, resonates as to how we look back and the perspective and the proportion. I don't want to say simple slogans, but sometimes a slogan can capture ideas that have been articulated. It could have been worse. Or we pull back the curtain on how well the world functions in general. Even something which is as directly related to the virus as the amount of viruses we live with on a daily basis and are necessary for our own life and our own support, or not viruses, at least bacteria and microorganisms that are necessary for our digestive tract, for our general bodily functions, the world we inhabit, our interaction with the animal world. So all of a sudden in 2020, one virus made the leap from the animal world and humanity wasn't prepared for it. But how many millions, not being a biologist, how many millions of viruses are we living with right now? I'm speaking right now. How many millions of viruses or microorganisms am I living with in a healthy and a balanced and calibrated manner without which I won't be able to live? So that's the first part of the first Rashi and its relevance to post-corona emunah thoughts. The second Rashi is, I think, equally helpful. Second Rashi, again, I'm driving, so I'm not going to read the Rashi, but more or less, I think it's from either Medrash Tanchuma or Moshe Adarshan, tells the story of a father and a child who were on their way to a doctor to heal a severe medical condition. And on their way back, they counted, or they listed, they enumerated all the locations they visited together. And more or less, Rashi's point is that in this parable, the father and the son are clearly not tranquil on their journey. This is a very, very stressful journey. A lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear. Will this doctor that they're traveling to be able to provide a medical solution for their illness? And you would think that on the way back, presumably having been healed, presumably having received a bill of health, that the last thing they'd want to do is relive those stressful moments. We call it memory repression. We repress the moments in our past that are painful to us. And yet the father and the son enumerate their locations. Again, I don't know the language of the Medrash. I apologize. I'm in the car a lot this summer. I'm teaching in different locations. But more or less, the language of the Medrash is because they were together. The father and the son were together. And despite the stress, and despite the sadness, and the grief, and the uncertainty, and the just they want to relive the fact that they underwent this experience together. And it teaches us a lot about human relationships. Sometimes we can't provide solutions or remedies, whether it's for medical crisis or for general crisis, but we can provide togetherness, and we can provide that sense of not just sympathy, but of enduring an experience together. And just think about your own struggles, whatever you've been through in life, and you can probably remember the person that you went through that struggle with, whether it was the night in the hospital, or whether it was the emotional, financial, stressful moment, and who was there for you, if anyone, and that cements a relationship. But certainly in our relationship with Hashem, and this Medrash is not arbitrarily choosing a father and a son, but it's stressing the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our father, and for 38 years, he didn't speak to us, and for 38 years, we felt unliked and disfavored, but he was still there with us. And when we look back at those 38 years, despite all the death and all the sadness, and thinking about the parents that they lost, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with them. Or to retrace our steps back to Rav Amital's statement about the Holocaust, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with them in Auschwitz, and not just in our ability to detect small moments of kindness, but just the fact that Hashem is wherever you are, and you navigate that experience even when you don't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will or interest, much in the way that we live deep relationships with people we don't always understand, but we hope that the strength of our relationships outlasts the questions we have about their motives and their decisions, because we trust them. One day we may discover motives and decisions, but people who we really trust, that trust, it's a currency. It's a relationship currency. It allows the relationship to withstand moments of confusion, moments of uncertainty. And I'm thinking a lot about my own experience, and I certainly, and I don't want this to sound in any way like it's pontificating, because it's really hard to speak about suffering, because everyone suffers differently, and about sadness and struggle and certainly emunah. And if you speak about it too confidently or too simplistically, it just comes off as off. It comes off as arrogant, as inauthentic, as disrespectful to people who may not achieve. And sometimes when I hear people speaking about it, it demonstrates, in my opinion at least, very little emotional sensitivity, emotional intelligence. To speak about emunah, I speak about Hilchos Hadlakas Ner Shabbos, because it's universal and standard, and how much wax you need and how you have to light, what bracha you have to make. But emunah is so personal, and it's such a struggle, and to speak about it in terms of confidence, I think, is inappropriate. To speak about it in honest and humble terms. So I think the same thing here. I felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence this past year and a half very deeply. A lot of what my life was built around was stripped away. My career changed, my travel changed, my family life changed, my financial situation changed, everything. A lot of the shells and layers that overlay my identity changed, and I have to look at myself in the mirror and say, well, who am I, and what is my identity, and what won't change, what isn't affected. And obviously the only thing that won't change is Hashem, Sali, and Mitzadasi, is my relationship with Hashem, which can't be affected by any vicissitudes or events. So I found that living through the process, I felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was present. Didn't understand much of what was happening, but as I said before, living with Hashem means you won't always understand His motives. And when I just thought of this Rashi, and I don't want this to be the Rashi share, because I've spoken about this Rashi in the past in a non-Corona setting, obviously, and I try not to repeat the Rashis as best as I can remember. But as I was getting to the car this morning, and I like to record on my way to some of my teaching responsibilities, it just hit me that this is a Rashi that bears reprocessing after the Corona tragedy. So I hope this is helpful, and good Shabbos.